T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Herbie! Let's go.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Sox Fest is coming up tomorrow, and it'll be one of the happiest Sox Fest that I can remember, considering what has been done here in the offseason by the White Sox. So we thought, we got Herbie with the Locked On Sox podcast. Like, we talked with him, and we had Mike Hall on the show yesterday. But considering the offseason and their fan convention is coming up tomorrow, that we would be on top of it. So I invited two of my friends into the studio. You hear them a lot, and they used to come in the studio at night, but now during the daytime, they have stuff to do, like covering baseball games, and Guff is producing, you know, Emmy award-winning stuff. But James Fagan, it used to be O'Fagan, and then it was Fagan when his family came here.
Oh, you
and
remember this story.
They've kind of settled on Fagan. And Ryan McGuffey from NBC Sports Chicago is here with me in studio.
As far as I know, always been McGuffey.
Well, I mean,
as far as I know.
Is it an O-Mac Guffey or something like
I don't
that.
Think it was an O. I do. It might have been a Guffey with a Mick added.
There could be like weird accent marks. There's some Scottish extra in there. Irish stuff or something.
There's some
like
Scottish
that.
In there, so.
Put Scott's the A back
fled,
in there?
Scott's fled, went to Ireland, added an O and a Mick most of the time. And so it could be, I guess it could be Guffey.
See?
I'll get back to you on that.
All right, find out. You need to do 23andMe and then get back to me and we can figure the whole thing out. Gentlemen, thanks for your time. I appreciate you both coming and hanging out with me in studio. I want to ask you a question that I asked Mike Hall yesterday. He's actually going to be running one of the panels at Sox Fest. On Saturday, he's running one. Are you more excited about the pickups that the White Sox made or the growth of the players that were already here? James, I'm going to start with you.
I don't know about excited. I don't know if their beat writers are allowed to be excited
anymore.
Don't
be excited.
I would say probably because they're eye-popping, because they're fun to talk about, because they're our job to kind of track it down, media can't help but overrate the importance of acquisitions when really the homegrown core of the team is probably what's going to actually carry more weight. So they could have done as much as they've done this offseason, which I think has hit every really goal that you could have set out for them. Or they could have done nothing, and probably the bigger thing that would sway their improvement is going to be whether Michael Kopech comes back to normal, whether Dylan Cease is an above-average starter going forward, whether Ronaldo Lopez comes back. Like the actual core that's going to carry the weight of the team was already in place, or was already, you know, they could fail too. That's already was in place before any of the moves they added. Like Enwin Encarnacion is a great add, but not the weight of the franchise is not on the shoulders of the 37-year-old DH on a 1-year contract. As much as that was like a singularly exciting moment of this offseason that kind of indicated how serious they were, it doesn't actually add that much value in the long, great scheme of things. So I would say the core.
I would say excited to see how that core takes another step with the addition of important veterans. So, you know, the Keuchels, the Encarnacions, the Gio Gonzalez's, how they add to and complement what's already happening and been happening the last 2 years. That's what if you're going to say excited, that's what I'm excited to see, how these young guys can now take a step with guys who have done it before. And they've kind of been growing up together and learning how to win together, and they haven't had that sprinkle of veteran leadership that's won and done it and been through rebuilds or hasn't been through rebuilds but have won and can show you rings. And now they can sit there and see that, or pick a brain of Dallas Keuchel when you're in a three-start slump, or even when you're in a three-start stretch where things are going well. Hey, what worked for you the year you won the Cy Young? I think all of that's going to be important to see how this goes forward.
Both of you guys have done extensive work on these guys getting to the major leagues. I know that, James, you travel around and talk to all sorts of people. And, Guff, you've done the same thing. You've been to Birmingham. Did you go to Winston-Salem, too?
Yeah.
So for you guys, seeing these guys make it, guys that 2-3 years ago you were covering as minor leaguers actually make the trip and make it to the major leagues. What's the most important thing about their story that White Sox fans need to know? You can pick whomever player you want.
The most important, like of a particular player, like I think Michael Kopech now is so, I think the way we think of him from interacting with him is so different from probably what he was in Boston. He would say as much the same as far as his demeanor, as far as his footwork, his game, had, you know, just the polish of his delivery. You know, he was somebody who obviously had top of the rotation stuff or just firepower from the draft. But, you know, there was makeup concerns that, you know, some other teams have cited for why they didn't even, they thought, you know, given the incident that he had when he was in Boston, that he was kind of a hothead or something like that. Michael Kopech now is like the nicest, most approachable mm-hmm. dude. He talks about having mental balance all the time. He seems like someone who is as well suited to be like a representative of an upfront guy as for this team as anyone I could probably pick off the roster. And that's probably people who maybe don't discount player development a little bit or kind of think guys who they are coming out of the draft. He's probably the biggest like example of somebody who really changed who they were over the course of a 4 or 5 year period. And yeah, I feel like I've gotten to know him or at least see that a little bit over this past period. And that's probably the benefit of this rebuild for someone discovering the team.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think, look, I mean, and I'm speaking for James here, but half the reason we went down on the farm and did all that stuff is because people are more connected to this stuff than ever before. You can watch minor league baseball games. You don't have to sit there and look at a box score from last night. People can find these guys 24/7. And when you have a team that says we're committed to rebuilding and fans have to buy into that, they're committed to looking at who these guys are when you trade Chris Sale and Jose Quintana and Adam Eaton and who they are when you draft a top 10 pick and you want to get to know them. I think half of that, at least 50% of that was just, let's show these people, let's introduce these people 3 years prior to when you're ever going to see them. So when they do come up, they're going to feel like we've already let them inside to who they are. And quite frankly, I think it's a two-way street. I think if you ask these guys that we've covered, they probably have benefited from the coverage as well. So when they get up to Sox Fest or the major leagues and their debut, they've kind of been there, done that, so to speak, with some people in the media already.
Guff, do you think that there's anything to the idea of, I know we're talking about an entire fan base, but a maturation of the fan base from that particular vantage point where the fan base was told, we're burning it all down and we're starting over. And then there seemed to be the reason that NBC Sports Chicago started airing games in Charlotte and Birmingham is because there was an actual interest in watching the development angle of it. What do you think that says about the White Sox fan?
Well, I think they've grown up too. And I think you're right. I think for a rebuild to work from top of the organization all the way down to like the bottom of the fan base, that you all want to be in it together, but the fans are probably the last group that's going to buy in. And so while you're educating and showing and learning who these people are, and that was what James and I are doing, and so does, I mean, the last 3 years or 4 years or whatever it's been, you can show them like, hey, look, there's proof because this guy we drafted 2 years ago is now in AA, and people are screaming, why isn't he up in AAA yet? And why isn't he in the major leagues yet? And I think that is maturation of a fan base, because if you could go back down 2 years prior to that and ask that same fan who's now begging and pleading that player to be up in AAA or the major leagues, maybe that fan doesn't buy in right away when they're trading Chris Sale because they don't understand it. And that part I understood. I think from a media perspective, and James, I'm curious, I don't know, maybe you can chime in on this. There's got to be buy-in from us too, because you're going, oh God, like what's the story now? You know, like you might have to work a little harder. Like you might have to do something unconventional and outside the box that's going to help you 2 or 3 or 4 years from now.
Well, honestly, James, that's one of the things I really like about your coverage is that you were willing to say, yeah, I'm going to go cover this minor league stuff. I'm going to keep you updated on what's going on with the prospects. That the major league team, while it's important, it isn't really where things were at. How did you and the Athletic come to that editorial decision on what type of stuff you were going to give to the White Sox fan as far as coverage goes?
I mean, I don't want to take too much credit for that because it was kind of my editor telling me, like, hey, you're going down there. And switching to that approach, it wasn't necessarily – I mean, I didn't really know – based on watching other beat writers, I didn't really know that was a possibility to just, like, peace out on the team for weeks at a time and go to watch single A. But it was kind of apparent given so much of the returns of the trades they were doing and where their draft picks were and given the fact that how much attention was on the – you know, top prospect list and where they ranked as far as organizational strength is all about dudes who are in A-ball, and it only made sense to be there. I mean, that's where the attention that when you were talking to Rick in 2017, those are the type of guys we talk about. You talk about Mike Rodolfo. You talk about, you know, Lucas Giolito was in AAA back then. It seemed like the story was very clearly in North Carolina and not entirely in Chicago. So it just seemed like a logical path, and it was more about having the willingness to say, like, actually, we're not as married to this concept of having someone writing up every single game, even though that's the way it's always been. And I think some of that was the Athletic game started out and just trying to distinguish itself in some way and just thinking that having a kind of investment in the idea of doing something different just to see if it would work. So I think I kind of benefited from that more accidentally. Obviously, once I started doing it, I loved it. I realized how much you could have a really more open atmosphere when it's not like a bunch of media crowded in one place for 45 minutes trying to grab guys, and you're more like you're the only reporter, and you're kind of like you're kind of dropped and you're almost embedded a little bit with the minor league team because there's no one else there, and you kind of watch everybody, you know, go through their routine, and you watch scouts watching the game, and you can kind of absorb everything more than, and you're just trying to get your tiny little piece of something unique when you're in a major league clubhouse. And I can't even, you know, compare it to like the Cubs during the World Series run. I'm going to be so irritated much of the year with how much media is going to be in the clubhouse. It's going to be so unfamiliar.
Glendale's going to suck for you this year.
I'm with you.
I'm going to be
I have the camera. I mean, beat writers and cameras don't go hand in hand, but James and I have been together so many damn times now that we just kind of I certainly respect what he's done, and we've done a lot of the same type of things without getting in each other's way. And I think that's because I think it's – and that's respect. And I mean, James has earned that. I hope I've earned that. And you can get two different stories sometimes through the same interview. We've combined player interviews in the minor leagues and or the Dominican Republic last year.
When we went to Ronaldo's house in the Dominican Republic, that'd probably be the prominent example.
That would be the prominent example. But his full feature read completely different from the visual feature that we saw. And as a matter of fact, they complemented each other perfectly. So that's been part of like this maturation process for us too. And this whole thing's about relationships. Like if you don't have relationships with these guys, you're not, I mean, how much are you really going to get? And you talked about being like almost embedded. You felt like you were a Winston-Salem Dash sometimes when you were down there, and the relationship you have with Michael Kopech, the relationship you have with not just him, all 30 of these guys, you know, even the guys that might not be a part of this, that might not work out either here or might be part of another organization down the line. You could send a message to them and just say, hey man, like, thanks for your time. Hat tip to you. Best of luck. And there's an appreciation for that too, that I've really enjoyed.
Let me ask you both about the feedback of that. James, I'm going to start with you. What type of feedback did you get from listeners, and did they have to change? Because you probably were going to get the person who was used to getting a box score and reading what the reporter thought about the game. And you're in Charlotte. So what type of feedback did you get from Sox fans as you were building this stuff up from the minor leagues to the Dominican?
I mean, I got immediate tons of feedback that was exactly what they wanted, that they wanted me to write, you know, about everybody, that they even appreciated the idea that I wrote like multiple features about Joel Booker, who was like this speedy double-A outfielder who's kind of plateaued a little bit with the bat and is kind of mixing between double-A and Charlotte. Might not be like a big core piece, but people just wanted everybody that there was a little bit of excitement about, they wanted to hear about, which made it funny because you talked about the transition of the fan base. I kind of think of it's more like a mode of right now. They got into themselves into a situation of focusing on every single thing as far in terms of long-term development and not thinking about the short-term ever, and they're probably going to need to shift out of that a little bit. But it was funny because I was in Birmingham last year during May, and I was covering Luis Robert, and I don't think Madrigal was there, but like Blake Rutherford, Zach Britt, there are other prospects there. I figured I'm where I'm supposed to be. The White Sox went on the stretch where they like won 6 out of 7. Yep. They like got into second place because they swept Cleveland. And I like the first time I got feedback from fans like, what are you doing in Birmingham during like this best stretch of the season? Like, why aren't you like, we want to hear about the big league team. I'm like, I'm kind of like, man, I'm covering Luis Robert here. What are you talking about? But it's also like, yeah, that's what I would like to see, is shifting back towards being a fan of the team on a daily basis and kind of investing yourself in the daily grind of this team trying to win every night.
Guff, did you experience any similar feedback from people?
It was similar. I mean, it just left people wanting more. And what I thought was always funny, you mentioned Joel Booker, but like, people, you tell people about Moncada and Kopech, and they want to know, like, well, what about Basabe? Don't forget about him. And Victor Diaz or whoever, the fourth player in these trades, people are like, hey, you've told me about these two, but what about those two? And it's like, well, okay. I mean, but, like, what you appreciate, like, that shows you, like, how far that they had taken the meter and moved it all the way over. But, yeah, I think there is this kind of transition mode back to, cool, like, I hope there are no more games in Charlotte this year. Or, you know, do you really have to go down to Birmingham? And the good, the point is, like, Charlotte's still going to matter early on. You know, Nick Madrigal's going to be there. Michael Kopech, he might be there. And Andrew Vaughn is going to be a double A. I mean, there are still guys worth watching in the minor leagues with the White Sox system right now. So, but I do think James is right. I mean, you invest in a mode like this so you can get to a mode like we're currently at today, to be excited about Sox Fest and the potential for this window to officially be pushed open.
Can you guys stick around for another segment?
Yeah,
sure.
Because I'd like to switch modes and talk about the 2020 season of the White Sox and how I think that White Sox fans are going to find themselves in that place that James was talking about real quick. And then I hope this White Sox as an organization are ready for that, because now it's expectation time. So I have two great guests, James Feegan from The Athletic, Ryan McGuffey from NBC Sports Chicago. They cover the White Sox. We're talking White Sox baseball with you here on the
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medella is your reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
I mean, that's what we've put on ourselves as well. I mean, we're always going to want to be a competitive team, and we're going to want to be a competitive team at the highest level, and that's going to be in the playoffs. And so those expectations that people are putting on us, like I said, we're going to also put on ourselves, and we're going to try to achieve that.
Michael Kopech talking about the expectations on the 2020 Chicago White Sox. James Feegan from The Athletic, Ryan McGuffey of NBC Sports Chicago are here in studio with me. I'm Lawrence Holmes. We're talking about the White Sox. Before we get to the expectations, we had an interesting little conversation off air. Why is Sox Fest at McCormick Place this year, from what you guys have learned, instead of it being at the hotel?
I think they were interested in making it definitely like a 2-day event. And I think that the fact that it's in one location on one floor. I've been over there. We have a plethora of shows starting tonight that'll be live from there, and it's just one gigantic, like, think auto show floor. So I mean, it's from the time you walk in to the main stage, it's a good 1,000 feet. And I think the interest of having everything together on one floor, I mean, as you guys have known the last few years, it's like escalator up, turn left, down this escalator.
To this, like, exhibit hall.
I never got used to it. And like, I felt like nothing ever changed. The opening ceremonies never changed. Rick and Ricky never changed. And I still found myself like turning the map. This kind of just lays it all out. And I think the 2-day event, to the interest in a 2-day event, like, if they knew that they could sell out 3 days, I'm sure that they would, yeah, we'll make it 3 days. I think that this was an experimental thing to kind of see how this goes. And obviously it's gone well enough to sell out both days this year. So we'll see.
James, you good with this?
I mean, the logistical argument is what makes sense as far as, like, if you're taking a 3-day event and squeezing the same amount of autograph tables, activities and whatnot,
right,
into a space, it needs to be a larger space. The more rhetorical argument is that the horde of insane Sox fans is so big it can't be held in that hotel anymore because they're so excited about Steve Cishek rounding out the bullpen. And, you know, it'd be chaos. There'd be like chairs and paninis everywhere if they're in the Hilton Chicago again.
I can't. How can I?
You can't argue with his deadpan delivery. James, what's the most interesting part of what the White Sox did in the offseason for the 2020 season?
Like, I would probably go back after just saying that it wasn't all that meaningful in the long run. The most interesting thing was probably signing Encarnacion to me because it felt unnecessary. Because they already, when they signed Grandal, because they talked about, they didn't talk about the preseason upgrading catcher necessarily. They talked about improving DH and right field, but Grandal would still do that because he's a good hitter, and you would have the two catcher rotation, and you could match them up and spread them out to DH, Grandal or McCann against lefties. They already had a roster that was competitive from a lineup standpoint, and then they just kind of added to it for the sake of it. And it was, given that it's a one-year deal for a 37-year-old guy, yes, there's an option for 2020 or 2021 if he continues to be great and whatnot, but it just seemed like, let's just add another piece that makes us even better for 2020, a year where they'd probably say, if you ask them on record, you know, we'll see how we develop. Maybe we compete for the division. We just want to take a step forward. That's really thing. It's a move that's really just saying, let's just pump up our win total projection just a little. Let's give ourselves a little bit more margin for error. Let's give ourselves another weapon to kind of take down the Twins. It hints at some aggression behind what's always, when you talk about it, is more of a cautious, measured approach of building up for a sustained window. It's a lot. It's a little bit of like, let's win in 2020. Let's do this type of a feel to their offseason that maybe is not present. Even when you have a nice 4-year deal for an elite catcher who is probably going to be productive while this team is at their best. So it was a lot more of an immediate kind of gut injection of talent.
Same question to you, Gov.
For me, I look at the whole thing and just say I think it's about fit. And for the first time after like a whole free agency is well, it's still ongoing, but almost over, as I just look at the guys that they've added, they've not only plugged the holes that they went out and talked about, but they just seem to be the guys that fit in on every way possible in the organization, in the clubhouse, on the field. And I'm not sure in the past that was always the case. I think they were plugging holes and concerned about plugging holes and just plugging the holes. And now you look at, like, I'll just be honest with you, I was concerned about like Zach Wheeler, and I'd started to do a little homework on trying to figure out if he was the type of guy you give a franchise altering contract to, because he was in New York, he's behind DeGrom and Syndergaard. He can go to Philly now, and regardless of $125 million or 118, whatever he got, he's always behind Bryce Harper. So maybe sometimes those guys, and a lot's been said about Rendon like that, you know, Rendon, phenomenal at baseball. Does he love the game, or is he just really great at the game? Some of the people I talked to at the winter meetings, that was posed to me, and now he goes to L.A. He makes $275 million. Is that what it was, $275?
Mm-hmm. He'll never come close to the Mike Trout money.
Never going to be the guy. I mean, his manager is going to take the spotlight away from him more than maybe he gets.
And then Ohtani.
Yeah. So the Dallas Keuchel conference call stood out to me. Like, that was a guy, it was kind of like, okay, like, yeah. That's the guy you bought for the 4 days he's not on the mound. Like, to me, he's as valuable on those 4 days he's not pitching to the day he is pitching. And the other thing that I'll say about not just the fit, I think, look at the terms of these deals. 1-year deals, 3-year deals, 4-year deals. That's like, they're all short-term, short-window type deals. And it allows you flexibility going forward in 21, 22, 23, as you learn more about how this team is going to embrace winning and expectations and spotlights.
Yeah, it was, to me, the Grandal thing was so important because I felt like that was the announcement. Like, that was the, okay, so we hear the jokes. We know all about the Manny Machado thing from last year. The White Sox are open for business, and we are looking to build for this 2020 team right now. And then it was real quiet after that, and you're like, oh, well, they're letting people get away, and I was really impressed by the way that Rick was flying around the country and working all of this stuff to put together a pretty cohesive offseason. It's rare that even one of the staunchest critics, my executive producer is one of them, can look at an offseason for a baseball team and go, they kind of got a lot of the stuff that they needed. Like, if you were looking at the list of things that you wanted to check off for the White Sox, you'd be pretty excited about what they've done. So let me ask you this, James. Is there anything that they didn't get that they still do need?
It's all, like, they could have upgraded. Their bullpen is not, like, you know, rock solid, absolutely invulnerable. But this bullpen market was, in my opinion, really bad. And when they, by the time they signed Cishek, who, as he told us, they called 5 minutes after the World Series ended, and we were working him for 3 months, he was probably the last reliever on the market that I would say, like, yeah, that's worth it, add him. Everybody else was like, well, if you like him, if you see something in his Statcast profile, if there's something about the spin you think you can make work, fine. But no one here is like, you're doing a disservice to your team if you don't go out and add. So I would say there's definitely weaknesses on the roster. Like, definitely the rotation is unproven by nature. But I don't think there's any task that I outlined that I would say they really need to address this that they didn't do. I wouldn't have said it's reasonable to them to expect them to get everything done that they did get done this offseason. So I don't really, as someone who definitely tries to mine every opening for to criticism or at least critique, I don't really have something this offseason that I feel like would be especially fair. I never was really talked into the idea that they need to sign somebody to be the second baseman for 3 weeks until Nick Madrigal came up. I did think that they would have a sizable, meaningful upgrade over Leury García and Danny Mendick that really makes sense, though. If they did it, fine, but I that never seemed like a really compelling, if you're, once you're debating about something like that, I feel like things are probably going pretty well. So there's not really an offseason need I think they didn't do. I think there's obviously still weakness with the team. I obviously think they're probably still in the middle 80s if anybody calculates their win projection, but that's all about the internal development at this point. I don't think you can point at their offseason and say you didn't do this.
Should we be worried that their outfield defense looks problematic? And here's why I say, and I know we talked about this a few weeks ago. Fine, you got Robert, and I watched him. I went down to Birmingham. I love watching him play outfield. But it's still a player that has to get used to major league ballparks, major league hitting, and major league hitters. And you've got two guys in the corner that I think are going to have him running from gap to gap to try and make plays. Is there any reason to believe that Aloy will be better defensively this year?
He has to be. I mean, is there
other than that?
Is there reason to believe? I think yes. There's reason to believe. I mean, I think that he's I'm like trying to convince myself maybe. I think he has to be better. I think that White Sox know he has to be better. I'm just more like, you can't put him, he can't put himself in harm's way ever again like he did last year, where he was more of a liability to himself than he was to the team. And when he's a liability to himself, he is a liability to the team. So I think, like, that to me is almost as important as getting better defensively. As long as he doesn't put himself in harm's way, he will be better defensively. But you're right. I mean, I don't think that Luis Robert getting adjusted to the major leagues is going to change his instincts. So he's instinctual, a great player, a great defender. I don't, gap to gap, wherever ballpark he's in, he's been changing ballparks so much the last 3 years in the minors in some of the worst facilities you'd ever seen, that that part doesn't concern me. I'm just worried about the guys in the corners that he is chasing down, saying, like, if you feel that steam engine coming, just get the hell out of the way. So there, to me, there is reason to be concerned about the corner defense. I mean, it's something that Ricky is, he's not going to hide behind that. He knows that they have to be better there.
I think it'll be a weakness of the team, for sure. But yes, I think Eloy will be better. I don't necessarily think Eloy will ever be a necessarily average defender in left, but everything that's been said about him is that he's a, you know, great makeup guy who's a good worker. So I think he's only naturally going to get better. He's not, if you like break down his sprint speeds, he's not objectively slow. Maybe his bursts aren't that great, and obviously his reads haven't been great.
I think his reads make him slow.
And if Rick Renneria wants to kind of on the low, he doesn't have to tell us, just kind of institute a fine if he ever tries to climb the wall again. That's fine. That'd probably be sound management. But yeah, I think he will definitely get improve over the course of the next 2-3 years. I just don't think he'll ever make it to that strength. And so the fact that you have a kind of a similar build guy in Mazar on the other end, that the outfield defense is not going to be great. On the one hand, 3 years of everyone saying Adam Engels needs to be a fourth outfielder, you got great defense, but running him out there every day in the lineup is not good use of him. Finally, he's in the right role after kind of watching him suffer and go through his development in real time in the majors. Now, finally, he's in the perfect assignment where he can be the guy who slides in the seventh inning and plays great defense and pushes Robert to a corner. I guess, good for keeping him around since now you can use him right.
Is that what you suspect will be the 26th man? Because I think that that's kind of interesting.
Do you?
What do you guys think they'll do
today
with that spot?
It's hard to say.
I can see. I mean, I think you look at this roster and the thing they need is more defensive flexibility. So I think having Lurie float around and having Engel as available as a defensive replacement and having Mendick is probably more vital to him than, you know, squeezing on another bat, given that you signed Encarnacion and you have both McCann and Grandal at this point. If you have Collins or Mercedes up there, it's already difficult enough to find a way to get McCann at bats. I don't know how you necessarily get it with Collins and Mercedes. So I think they probably are just mashing in AAA, waiting for an opportunity.
And picking up, I mean, I think flexibility is the most important, but I mean, with the bullpen, I think, like you mentioned, I think there is a question mark or two there that could also, I think there's going to be a lot of mixing and matching on the 26th man. And that's another reason why it's there, to give you flexibility.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about 26 man and the last guy in the bullpen all spring training, and then that guy, somebody's option within the first week of the season all the time. So,
yeah, it doesn't really matter to be. I mean, there's going to be, they know what they want. They're looking at the calendar. They're not looking at 26 man on March 26 as much.
How does Yoan Moncada go from the guy that he was, especially in September? My goodness, that guy. To the next thing, whatever you two think the next step is for him, or is he already to the point where this is who he is as a player? Is there still more development to go?
Yeah, I mean, I think he can make more contact. I think he has the bat speed and then the idea of his plate approach that he can further trim that strikeout rate to probably 25%. I think his walks will probably come back a little bit, given just how much he'll get avoided, given the power he showed last year. But otherwise, I think he's mostly the guy. Maybe he can somehow improve enough that he takes a step between being the 22nd place AL MVP finisher to maybe the 10th place guy.
Courtesy of someone in this room. By the way, I defend your MVP vote for him. I absolutely 100% defend it. He's a 5-WAR player last year.
Well, for Fangraphs, he was a near 6-WAR player, which was more what I was based off of, given that was what he had him above DJ LeMahieu, who apparently it was a very big deal that I omitted. But
there were plenty of people that were on the list, because I went and looked. Plenty of people that finished ahead of him in MVP voting, that he was a better player then. And I mean, just from a war standpoint last year. So I didn't think it was crazy. You got some grief for it, but I didn't think you were crazy, James, to give him an MVP vote.
Luckily, somebody didn't vote for Derek Jeter, so you've been absolved.
Guys, I thank you both for spending your day here. I know you both have work to do to get ready for Sox Fest. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing with the Score audience. Guff, you're doing great work with NBC Sports Chicago, and I know that there's going to be all sorts of stuff set up there over the next couple of days for fans. It's going to be terrific, and The Athletic is on top of it as well. So, boys, thanks for being in here and hanging out and talking White Sox with me.
Let's talk more Sox this year.
I think that is on the docket for sure. We need to take a break. I have a Blackhawks thought that I wanted to share. We'll do that coming up next here on The Score. Yesterday on the show, I talked a little Blackhawks with Jay Zawoski. It was a really fun conversation. We talked about Joel Quenneville, and we talked about him returning in the Blackhawks, how they've been playing well. They lost last night or two nights ago, but they've been playing well leading up to that. One of the more interesting parts of the conversation was in the celebration of Patrick Kane's 1,000th point. We talked about kind of Kane's legacy as far as the Blackhawks go. Listen to what Jay said about him.
I think when it's all said and done, Patrick Kane will be remembered as the best Blackhawk ever based on accomplishment, winning 3 Stanley Cups, winning MVP. I think he'll definitely catch Dennis Savard. He'll definitely catch Bobby Hull. The question is, can he get, I think it's 440 some more points to catch Stan Mikita? It's a tough task, but he's playing the best hockey of his career right now. He's having his best seasons at 29, 30, 31. So can he play for 5-6 more years? I think so. And I think that's enough time for him to reach those numbers. And he may be the leading scorer in Blackhawks history when his career ends. And that's remarkable. That's something I never thought in my lifetime I would ever see happen.
What if I argue with you that I think Jonathan Toews could go down as the greatest player in Hawks history? Is it just the fact that he won't have the goals to go along with all of the stuff that we can't necessarily quantify?
I think the numbers would hurt that argument a little bit. He's never been a high scoring. Well, he's a high scorer, but he's never been an elite scorer. And I think when you look at Stan Mikita, who is now the best Blackhawk ever, the two-way play was a huge factor for him. Not only did he have 1,400-plus points, he could play at both ends. He was an all-around player. That's what Taves is like. Taves is a more similar player to Mikita than Kane is. Kane is more of the Bobby Hull electrifying, you know, speed, agility, scoring ability. But I don't think Taves has enough on paper to make the argument his best ever.
I'm still thinking about this. Just because of what Taves does on faceoffs, what he does on defense as a two-way player, what he does in the corner to get you the puck, the fact that he's 19 years old, they put the C on his chest and he never wavered. I mean, Jay's the oracle on this. I trust his opinion, but there's a part of me that's because Patrick Kane, the question is, does Kane do so much offensively that you can disregard what he is on defense? And does Taves do enough all around that you can disregard the lack of points in comparison, even though he's closing in on 800 points himself?
This almost sounds like a Jeter type of thing.
Well, I think that Jonathan Taves is a better hockey player than Derek Jeter was a baseball player.
Agreed.
Ooh, that's a hot take. Ooh-wee, that is scorching hot.
Did you see the, was it New York Daily News or New York Post article?
About Mike Trout versus...
Yeah, who's better, Derek Jeter or Mike Trout?
And Mike Trout already has a higher award than him, and he's only played 9 years. And what did Derek play, 37 years?
Never seen a one-word article before.
No. All right, well, it's something that, I mean, I guess it's a perpetual argument. And you can, some people like chocolate and some people like vanilla. Thanks to Ryan McGuffey and James Fegan. That was a lot of fun to talk a little White Sox with them and then throw a little Blackhawks into the conversation too as they reach the break. It's fun times. We'll talk with McNeil and Parkins about what they're doing on their show coming up next. In fact, they'll have Michael Kopech on. You'll want to take a listen at 3 o'clock.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.